I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm James, and joining me on today's episode are Mike and Anne-Marie from the My Wall Street analyst team. Today, we're talking about how the Elon Musk fiasco has the potential to completely ruin Twitter as a company, the fallout from the Uber files leak and the viability of the ride-sharing industry as a whole, and why you can expect to hear a lot of talk about the strength of the dollar versus the euro this earnings season. Mike and Marie, welcome to this week's Stock Club. Before we start off, I'm just going to repeat my usual spiel. We have an extended version of the Stock Club podcast in the My Wall Street app now that you can listen to for free. In this extended version, either Mike or Anne-Marie are going to give us the full pitch for the company that they're giving the elevator pitch for at the end of the show. As I said, you can listen to this completely for free. All you have to do is go to the My Wall Street app, set up an account, and you can find that episode along with all of our past episodes and our first looks, which are made from our elevator pitches. You can find all of that in the My Wall Street app now. Guys, I was going to start this off by saying welcome to the hottest episode of Stock Club ever, and not for any sexy reasons. It's just that it's incredibly hot here in Dublin. And you're in Dublin too, so I'm going to assume you're roasting. Mike, what's it like over on the other side of Ireland?
I just want to rewind to not for any sexy reasons. That's such a good sentence. Sorry. No, the heat's gone east. We had our day in the sun.
Yeah, you've got a big day on Sunday though, don't you?
100%.
What do you think the score is going to be?
Well, we're definitely underdogs, so I'd say we'll only win by about 6 or 7. We'll see.
All of our American listeners like, what are these guys talking about? We're talking about the All-Ireland football final. Google it if you're not sure what it is. And Marie, do you have any skin in the game? Do you have any interest?
Not in this All-Ireland final. When I was a kid and I would come to Ireland for the summers, my uncles used to take me to like the All-Ireland quarterfinal when Dublin would be playing. So I have about, and then it meant that subsequently any birthday or Christmas that came up, my uncles would just buy me a Dublin jersey. So at my closet at home in Colorado, I have about 10 Dublin GAA jerseys just sitting from
such
like
a classic dub. Just don't even pay attention to All-Ireland finals. Yeah. You've won so many of them. You can sense my bitterness as a Kildare man. Let's move on to more stock market related stuff. We're probably losing the room here. So before we get into our main stories this week, I just want to touch on, we're recording this on Wednesday. Last night, Netflix reported its Q2 earnings. And these were ones that people were really, really watching closely after the disaster that was its Q1 earnings a couple of months ago. Netflix, the top line headline, I suppose, was that Netflix lost almost 1 million subscribers. But funnily enough, people seemed actually pretty happy with that. Stock was up in pre-market trading as we record. What do you guys think of the report? How did this sound from Netflix? Anne-Marie, what were your thoughts?
I was actually pretty impressed considering that management went into the quarter and predicted that they were going to lose 2 million subscribers. So to cut that number by 50% is pretty significant. And they also projected that they will be returning to subscriber growth next quarter. So it's not too bad. I was also really impressed with the statistics that came out about Stranger Things. I mean, I have maybe a more long-term worry that Stranger Things only has one season left, but I think it's in some ways legitimized Netflix's strategy that they can find original IP and make it maybe as big as a Marvel TV show release on Disney Plus or something like that. I was also impressed to see that because they broke up Stranger Things' release and did a staggered method, which I had written about maybe a month ago or 2 months ago when Netflix kind of got in hot water when its Q1 for this year came out, I suggested maybe they need to look into staggering releases to build anticipation and kind of, you know, get that excitement going. And it was interesting to see them do that with Stranger Things, and they actually crashed the server in the United States. So many people were trying to watch the second part of the fourth season. So it definitely shows that there is still an audience for Netflix content.
Hold on a minute now.
Find the artist to make
it. Staggered releases, advertising coming into the platform. Is Netflix not just reinventing normal television, Mike?
Yeah, well, they didn't really tell you much about the advertising, did they?
Like, yeah.
I thought that was fair enough, I suppose. But this was kind of the earnings report where you expect more information, and it kind of just said, like, limited markets, maybe 2023, maybe we might tell you something then.
Yeah.
So that was a small bit disappointing, but I kind of would parrot Anne-Marie's point about Netflix have kind of always said that, either like saying it outright or through their actions, that, you know, the content makes up for everything else. And we saw this with basically predicting they'd lose 2 million and lose 1 million because Stranger Things is so popular, that does pay off. That attitude and that strategy does pay off. So it is interesting to see. I think as a whole, they're going to stay on top in terms of streaming.
Mm.
I think it's just, maybe is streaming's popularity in general at stake? And I think that's what the market has kind of priced in recently. So yeah, we'll see. It's a long way to go to kind of...
I've seen ads on television now for Paramount Plus here in Ireland, which we usually get things last. So it really shows the kind of saturation of the market. Let's move on, though. That's not what we're here to talk about this week. It feels like we've had a few glorious weeks away from this topic, but of course we've been dragged back in to the Elon Musk and Twitter fiasco, I think we can safely call it now. So as I'm sure half the world knows by now, Musk has decided that he actually doesn't want to buy Twitter anymore. He notified the company 2 weeks ago that he wanted to pull out of the deal because they didn't give him enough relevant business stats regarding spam accounts, according to him. Twitter, of course, isn't taking this lying down. The company's moving to sue Musk itself into actually buying the company for the previously agreed upon price of about $44 billion. Mike, this has been a long running saga, and I have a feeling it's going to continue long running. Musk has recently made some attempts to delay this lawsuit, but it looks like it's going to play out in court now in October. What are your initial thoughts on this? Why was he trying to push out the lawsuit?
Well, as we are wont to do when I start talking on this podcast, we put on our tinfoil hats for a minute.
Okay.
No, but one of the easy outs for Musk from this deal is if his financing falls through. So his legal team tried to get it pushed, the trial pushed to February 2023 and have this big prolonged court case. Whereas I think he has guarantees on some of the loans he got up until April 2023. So that would kind of solve all his problems there.
Okay.
Two things are kind of happening. One of them is mostly in Elon Musk's head, where he wants to make this trial about bots and spam accounts when it just isn't. It's better about whether or not he can walk away from this deal, and which I don't really think he can. If he did his due diligence before committing $44 billion to this kind of something measuring contest, like normal people would, and he had these conversations with Twitter before, and maybe if Twitter guaranteed that, say, 5% or less of the accounts on the platform are actually spam or bots, then maybe this legal case has a leg to stand on.
Yeah.
Maybe, but it doesn't. That's not what happened. There was no mention of bots in the acquisition. The only legal basis Musk kind of can rely on is if Twitter basically provided falsified accounts in its SEC filings.
Mm.
So this would be based around what Twitter says to the SEC about bots. So it says, in its own words, it uses significant judgment to figure out about 5% or less of its accounts are bots. Now, what this is saying is that Twitter doesn't know how many bots it has on the platform. It could well be more than 5%, but according to the process it uses internally, it's 5% or less. Doesn't guarantee this figure anywhere. It's an estimate, but what kind of has triggered Musk is the process itself. And in truth, it isn't great for a company of Twitter status. Like, it has human reviewers going through a sample of 100 random accounts every day, using their own discretion to decipher if they're spam accounts or not. So it's kind of amateur hour. And obviously this disgusted Elon, who was shocked there was no AI or machine learning or yada yada or whatever.
Brain implants.
But that doesn't mean Twitter has done anything wrong. You know, the trial should not be about bots. No mention of bots before the acquisition. And actually, with the judge ruling in favor of the expedited trial, we're on Tuesday, so yesterday, it doesn't look like it will be either. It will be about the acquisition itself, which probably doesn't fare too well for Musk.
Commentators have also said, you know, the recent market downturn and the fact that Tesla shares are down close to 30% since the offer was made, the fact that the value of Twitter itself has now fallen well below the price that kind of Musk agreed to pay back in April is part of the reason too. Do you think that's a fairly fair assessment?
Yeah. I think it could be. I think
part of the reason, probably.
Yeah, I think finding out how the bots were processed definitely triggered Musk. I think we're taking in kind of the tech stocks crashing right after he made what was then a lowball offer, which is now quite expensive. Tesla stock falling concurrently as well has made it again relatively more expensive because he has less money. There are theories that this is kind of all an elaborate plot to get away with selling a bunch of his Tesla stock. I'm not sure if you go through this many steps to do so. I'm not sure if you raise the financing. If that's your goal, there's also talk that this is kind of a negotiation tactic to get Twitter back to the table and maybe get a cheaper deal. But he's burnt an awful lot of bridges to do that. And like, yeah. You know, like he's dragged Twitter's name through the mud time and time again. And now with this, like going through the bots and everything as well, it's just, it doesn't seem like he... It seems like he just wants an exit strategy. So
yeah,
I'm not sure.
You mentioned like Twitter's name being dragged through the mud there. And you said, you know, there's a fairly significant chance probably that he will be forced to buy this company. Surely as, you know, Twitter itself and also Twitter investors, this isn't great for the company either. It's kind of a lose-lose situation. Elon Musk either backs out of the deal or they have somebody buy the company who clearly does not want to buy the company.
No, it's awful. It's awful for everyone. So we misquoted Emmett with the wrestling with the pig, and then you realize the pig is starting to enjoy it. yeah. Analogy, but it's you said it all. It's a lose-lose situation where Twitter's name has been dragged through the mud. This manhunt for bot accounts could severely damage its reputation amongst advertisers, and if the deal doesn't go through, the stock is going to plummet too. So you're wrecking shareholder value there as well. I think what has happened is that in trying to get the deal done, Twitter's board is trying to at least salvage that shareholder value.
Yeah.
But long term, for Twitter as a platform and as a business, it doesn't look good, which is such a middle finger to everyone because Musk and his grandstanding and the importance of Twitter as a town square and all that BS has actually led to the complete degradation of the platform. He himself has put on such a pedestal. So yeah, it's a complete mess and I don't really know where it goes from here.
Yeah, it's hard to see what's going to happen next. What do you think, Anne-Marie? Do you think Musk was ever really serious about buying Twitter?
No, I think on the podcast like 4 weeks ago, I was like, this deal's never going to go through. It's not going
to
happen.
Well,
so
we'll
I was in some ways delighted to see that collapse. I know I actually said it maybe 3 days before it happened to myself and Nicole were on an outside podcast and I was asked about the Twitter deal with Elon Musk and I was like, I don't think that's going to happen. And then like 3 days later, it was announced. So it's just very ridiculous. I do think in some ways it might be, this might be the end of the kind of cult-like following to some degree that Elon Musk has, because this is so ridiculous that maybe it kind of allows people to see that he's not on top of it all the time. I think sometimes people allow Elon Musk to get away with really crazy things because they assume he has some sort of insider knowledge and he's going to pull it off in the end. So it's been kind of nice to see that image of him be destroyed to some degree. I love it, but it's terrible for Twitter shareholders. If I was a Twitter shareholder, I'd be very frustrated because the platform still exists and is still used, and there's still, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people that enjoy using Twitter, and it's definitely an interesting platform. And it probably is a platform that could do with another person coming in and trying to figure out, how do you make money from this? How do you make this experience better? But I don't think that person was ever going to be Elon Musk, to be honest.
Yeah, so it's whatever feelings you might have about Elon Musk destroying his own personal image, destroying one, possibly two companies in the process, isn't fantastic to see. Speaking of shady management practices, let's move on to Uber. So they've been in the firing line for all the wrong reasons recently, after more than 124,000 confidential company documents were leaked to the Guardian newspaper in the UK by a former chief lobbyist for the company in Europe. The files mainly covered the five-year period when Uber was run by its founder, Travis Kalanick, who is an entire different story to himself that I think we covered on podcasts a couple of years ago.
He's a bad dude.
Yeah, he's not
bad apple.
He's
not
a
great.
Nasty piece of business. Wow.
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, what was uncovered in the papers was not pretty. Anne-Marie, Uber's long been one of probably the most controversial companies out there in terms of the personalities that run the company. Cough, cough, Travis Kalanick, some of the stuff that goes on within the company, but also its business practices and, you know, the effects it has on the markets it goes into, the way it treats its drivers, a whole host of things. What was the most noteworthy thing that came out of the leaks that somehow sullied Uber's image more?
Yeah, there were kind of my, I had two bullet points that were my favorite. The first was that in 2016, the company invested $90 million in a lobbying and public relations effort, with the idea behind it being they wanted to recruit friendly politicians, and they had an overarching goal of disrupting Europe's taxi industry. That was what they were going after. And this saw them achieve some face-to-face meetings with some pretty important people, kind of the world's foremost politicians. So Kalanick actually met with then Vice President Joe Biden at the World Economic Forum in 2015. And apparently he was really rude to Joe Biden, like really rude. And Joe Biden never met with him again. But Uber executives also achieved meetings with the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, with Irish Taoiseach Enda Kenny, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and with George Osborne, who at the time was the UK's chancellor. And some of these meetings bore actual fruit. So a great example of this was when taxi drivers went on strike and began to riot in Paris in response to Uber launching there. Kalanick ordered French executives to retaliate by encouraging Uber drivers to stage a counter-protest. And Uber executives went to Kalanick and they were like, this is not a good idea. The taxi rioting had actually been triggered by extreme right-wing thugs who had kind of infiltrated the protest. And they went to Kalanick and they were like, you can put Uber staff at risk by encouraging this behavior. And he said, quote, I think it's worth it. Violence guarantees success. And these guys must be resisted, no? That's an exact quote that they pulled from an email of his.
That's like, if that was a Bond villain said that, you'd be like, no, that's a bit overdramatic. I don't really believe that.
Yeah, like he should be holding a white hat, heading it, while he delivers that line. And all the while, it was also revealed in these documents that Emmanuel Macron, who was the president of France, was in direct communication with Kalanick while these riots were going on. And according to The Guardian, it appears that he went to extraordinary lengths to help Uber during this period. And that's pretty significant. And in other countries, he enlisted the backing of really powerful figures. So in Russia, Italy, and Germany, there is evidence that Uber offered prized financial stakes in the company, and they offered to turn some people into, quote, strategic investors, which is very fancy language for saying bribery, to be honest.
Sounds a lot like free money.
Yeah. But I mean, I suppose it is worth mentioning that not all of Uber's efforts were met warmly. So Uber officials met with now German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who at the time was the mayor of Hamburg, and he pushed back against Uber lobbyists and insisted that you needed to pay the drivers minimum wage, which meant then 2 days after this meeting, some Uber executives were discussing it via WhatsApp, and they said that Scholz was a real comedian. Oh. Which is not a great reflection of your company when you refuse to pay your driver's minimum wage.
Not even that you refuse, but the prospect of it is a joke.
It's laughable, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not good.
And my kind of second bullet point that I loved that came out of this leak is it revealed that the company used, quote, stealth technology to fend off government investigations by installing kill switches in all Uber servers across the globe. So this meant that when police would raid facilities, particularly in European countries, to search for evidence of bribery or participation with the government, they could hit a kill switch and it would basically cut off all the servers and delete all the information so that people couldn't conduct any sort of investigation. And this has meant that legal experts said that these actions could raise questions about obstructing justice in France, the Netherlands, India, and Hungary. So there might be some investigations coming Uber's way.
All in all, not a great look for Uber. But of course, it's important, I suppose, to mention that a lot of this happened a number of years ago. There's obviously a new CEO in place now. I know the company's done a lot of work in kind of rehabilitating its image. Do you think, you know, this is a fair reflection of Uber as a company today?
The BBC, in response to the leak, said that it was an example of the ruthless business methods of Uber's previous CEO, Travis Kalanick.
Yeah.
So I do think it's more of a reflection of him than it is of the company. It's important to remember that he was forced out of Uber because he created such an incredibly toxic environment that it was unsustainable. Tens of thousands of employees exited Uber in the months leading up to he basically being forced out by the board, even though he controlled the vast majority of the voting shares. Uber several days ago actually did put out a response to the Guardian leak saying that the company did make mistakes prior to 2017, but these have already been reported at length, and it culminated in, quote, one of the most infamous reckonings in the history of corporate America. So Uber does seem to have an acknowledgement that this period is not something that it's proud of, and it feels that it has dealt with that. Uber also said that Kalanick's successor, this last name, Dara Khosrowshahi?
Yeah, I went with new CEO.
Yeah. I wrote it down phonetically. I think we're close. Uber basically said he was tasked with transforming every aspect of how Uber operates, and it is a different company today. And to be fair to him, he has a 92% approval on Glassdoor, and he did remove a significant number of executives when he came in. It does seem to have been kind of a clean sweep. So we have yet to hear about any bribing of government officials, but you never know.
Yeah, we might get another leak in a few years' time. But one thing that really struck me kind of reading through the reports in these files was the fact that, Uber was putting on the government here in Ireland, which was obviously of local interest to us. More than 5 years later, Uber still failed to launch here along with other key European markets. And it's facing increasing regulation and competition in the markets where it does exist. Kind of putting our investor hats back on, I suppose, what does this say about the ride-sharing industry as a whole? Uber is a company I know we constantly kind of look at. We're constantly, you know, reading about it. When its earnings come out, we would pay attention to it. Do we really see a future in this ride-sharing industry that seems to be getting more and more compressed?
To be honest, I think this report and other reports that we have heard recently in terms of Uber and other ride-sharing apps really does prove that the business model is only viable, particularly in major cities, if you're cutting corners or you're subsidizing rides. There's no other way to pull this type of this thing off. And a great example of that is if we look at taxi licensing, which is something that you have to have in most major cities in the United States. You need to be licensed to be a taxi driver. Those can be very, very expensive. In New York in particular, it's very expensive. You need to have a taxi driver medallion. And in 2014, prior to Uber's launch there, it cost $1 million to get a taxi medallion. But the reason they're so expensive is that there's a very finite number of them. And in order for you to buy one, you have to find a taxi driver who's retiring and you buy it from him. The benefit of these taxi medallions is that it guaranteed these people a right to work, and it basically guaranteed them a livable wage because there was a limited number of taxi drivers. It also was basically their retirement plan, because it meant that when you got to the end of your career, you know, you're 65 and you sell your medallion on, then you get to take that income. And many of them are living off of that. As soon as Uber launched in the city, this entire industry was decimated. And consequently, 96,000 cab drivers of New York City are suing Uber over basically them being debt ridden. I've read stories of taxi drivers in New York who have $600,000 and $700,000 in debt that they now have no way to pay off because Uber has taken their jobs. And, you know, it's just a reminder that, you know, regulation sometimes is needed for certain industries. You know, if you flood the market with all these drivers who are willing to take on a couple hours a day, it means that everyone is just getting a small amount.
Yeah.
It means you can't have drivers who their entire livelihood is driving a car. And so that has now kind of come full circle, particularly in the case of New York, because there's actually now a driver shortage in New York City because all these taxi drivers began to retire or go into other industries. And so Uber, about 3 months ago, was forced to strike a deal with the yellow cab companies of New York to put all the taxi cabs on Uber's app because Uber couldn't find enough drivers who were willing to use their own vehicles. And the taxi cab companies had basically created such a public issue that many people were refusing to use Ubers altogether, and they were getting back into cabs. And we've seen the exact same thing happen in London, where as Uber began to raise fees in the cities, people are going back to the classic black taxi cabs.
Yeah.
And so in my view, it's just a reminder that like Uber was only ever disruptive in places that didn't have a traditional regulated like taxi industry. And that's places like college towns or smaller cities. For example, like I grew up in Denver, and we do not have this kind of taxi culture. The city is spread up over a much further distance. So, you know, we don't kind of have that traditional infrastructure there. So it meant that Uber was great for us, but it didn't really make sense to enter cities that have a taxi culture, which is what we have in Dublin. The reason that Uber was not allowed to come in is because we have a taxi licensing system that Uber was forced to honor. So now the only people who are allowed to use the Uber app in Ireland are registered taxi drivers.
Yeah, interesting. What about you, Mike? Is, you know, we've got Uber, we've got Lyft, publicly listed companies. Ever any interests or thoughts of adding them to the shortlist?
No, I wouldn't back them. I think Anne-Marie kind of said this point throughout her analysis there, in that a VC-backed Uber or a VC-backed Lyft, where they're subsidizing rides and spending investor money to gain reach and gain customers, is a very different entity to a taxi company, essentially.
Yeah.
And Rory used to always say this, that they kind of sold us this lie of, oh, you can basically afford your own personal chauffeur because we're spending Sequoia or Andreessen Horowitz's money on you getting a taxi home this evening for £5 instead of what should be £30.
Mm.
And I think that's almost kind of a study on like post disruption what happens.
Yeah.
And this is where it is, where it's like Uber did the disrupting. It broke up the taxi business. It gained that market share. And I think it gained, like, it created habits amongst especially kind of younger generations of accepting this kind of convenience. And now the bottom is kind of falling out of it because it was never a sustainable business model in the first place. So
yeah,
I'm not sure where it goes from here in terms of once a customer is used to a level of convenience, it's hard for them ever to go back.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah, it's that race to zero. We see it with other industries, like I suppose the brokerage industry, which is obviously one we're quite adjacent to. And you know, when everybody's racing to zero and subsidizing fees and things like that, it does come to a point where it's just not viable for any of them anymore. Let's move on then. And don't forget, as I mentioned at the start, if you listen to this podcast in the My Wall Street app, you get the full version of one of our elevator pitches at the end of this episode. Mike and Anne-Marie are both going to pitch me companies. I'm going to pick one of them and we're going to hear the full pitch for that company. You can only find that in the My Wall Street app. You can download it on iOS or Android and just create a free My Wall Street account then. There's a link for that in the notes for today's show. Funnily enough, one of the recently extended elevator pitches that featured on this podcast just this week became the new stock addition to our shortlist. Mike, it was a company you pitched. Can you give us any very subtle hints to what's the company you added?
No. Sign in. Just create an account. See it for yourself. We're giving away too much for free on this podcast.
ever the salesman. Okay, let's move on and dig into the mailbag. And something that's been dominating the news recently is the fact that the US dollar and the euro have reached parity in terms of value for the first time in about 20 years. We're in the midst of earnings season, and already we've seen a lot of companies mention the effects of the strong dollar on their profits. IBM did a few days ago. Netflix actually mentioned it last night as well. Mike, can you briefly explain why the dollar is performing so well at the moment? And what does that mean, I suppose, in real terms for investors? And why does it affect these companies so much?
Yeah, I think that there's one main reason and then maybe one smaller reason. I think that the war in Ukraine has an outsized effect on what's happening in Europe right now,
yeah,
especially in the energy sector. But the main cause is that the dollar's rise has been because of the actions of the Fed. It's been much faster to react and much more aggressive with its rate hikes compared to other central banks around the world in this effort to fight inflation. And what's happening now is that it's actually working because the dollar's achieved parity against the euro. So all European imports are now about 20% cheaper straight off the bat. There's a lot of implications to this. Strong dollar goes much further than just a cheaper holiday for American tourists or Anne-Marie suddenly getting 20% richer. But I actually, you mentioned it with the earnings season already. Netflix and IBM have mentioned significant earnings losses because of it. I think it's going to be one of the key themes, especially for large US multinationals. So if you're a Netflix, you're reporting dollars, but you take in 60% of your income from other currencies, it's going to feel the pinch, you know? Microsoft, Salesforce, Costco, they've all warned of reduced profits as well. So yeah, it will see a lot of it. The Morning Brew actually shared an interesting rule of thumb this week. It said that an 8 to 10% jump in the dollar causes US company profits to drop by 1% on average. So I think that'll be a very common kind of excuse from here on out.
Yeah, so keep an eye out for that one this earnings season. As Mike said, I'm sure we'll hear a lot of things being blamed on it, just like inflation was in the last earnings season. Thanks a million for that, Mike. Let's move on to the elevator pitch then. So I'm going to ask both of you guys to pitch me a company that's on your watch list. I'm going to pick one, and then in the extended version, we're going to get the full pitch from one of you guys. Mike, I'll keep you on your roll there. What company are you pitching me today?
The company I'm pitching is called Aptiv. So it produces What amounts to the operating system for your car. So these systems, they're called advanced driver assistance systems. They're actually seen as a precursor to autonomous driving. So kind of encapsulates automatic brake detection, autonomous cruise control, like the stuff that keeps you in your lane, blind spot monitoring, all those kind of like dings and dongs that go off in the car if you're moving less than 1 feet out of
I believe
straight
that's
line.
The technical term.
Yeah. But yeah, it's an interesting business. It's got three main areas of focus. So like safety measures, as we mentioned, efficiency and green efforts. So it's big in terms of electric vehicles and the architecture that's involved in the computers there. And then connected vehicles. So essentially making your car a smart car. Not the tiny cars, but the, like, you know, like a smart home, a smart car. It also owns 50% of an autonomous driving startup called Motional through a joint venture with Hyundai. This is actually, I was surprised to hear this number. It's provided over 100,000 self-driving taxi rides with zero at fault incidents. So it's actually quite a ways along there. And while this all sounds a bit wishy-washy, it actually took in $15 billion in revenue last year. So it's a very legit company. This one, this one might make it to the long pitch eventually. We'll see.
Wow. Okay, interesting. Anne-Marie, what about you? What company are you pitching this week?
I'm kind of pitching a company in response to a company that Rory pitched 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, which was On Holdings, which is a shoe company that's been made popular by Roger Federer and is kind of, you know, one of these companies that claims to have cutting edge shoe technology. That got me interested in kind of up and coming running shoe companies. And one of the ones we talked about was called Hoka, which is a French running shoe company. So I went to take a look at them, but they are actually owned by Deckers, which also owns Uggs, Teva, Mozo, and Sanuk, which is another sandal company. So yeah, they're a really interesting business. You'd be surprised how much money you generate from Uggs every year. Would not have known that, but generated $3 billion last year. They're kind of beginning to diversify out their portfolio. They're in a really interesting phase, and I kind of like them. I like them better than Rory's pitch. We'll put it that way.
Is that payback after the time you robbed Rory's pitch?
Yeah.
Okay, both sound like really interesting companies, especially the dings and dongs of Aptiv. But I can't pass up the chance to talk about Uggs for an extended period of time. So Henry, let's go with Deckers. So guys, this is where we're going to leave you today. However, if you want to hear the full pitch from Anne-Marie on Deckers as an investment and see what we think about the company that owns the likes of Uggs and Hoka, please jump on over to the My Wall Street app now and you can listen to the rest of this conversation for free. There's a link in the notes for today's show. All you have to do is set up a free account and you can listen to this episode along with all of our past episodes of Stock Club and more great investing content. If you have any questions that you'd like us to answer or elevator pitches you'd like us to tackle on future episodes of Stock Club, you can always get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, on TikTok, that's at My Wall Street, or simply just email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's POD at mywallstreet.com. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to tell your friends about us and don't forget to leave a review or a rating for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. Thanks for joining us today. I won't talk to you next week as I'm taking a few weeks off, but I'm going to leave you guys in the capable hands of Michael Matheny. So he and the rest of the Stock Club crew will talk to you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.